Okay, we were escorting celebrities in Pittsburgh.
Well, when they, in the days that I worked, they used to, especially when Pittsburgh was a big television market, the eighth biggest market in the country, and then the 10th, they sent a lot of stars here before each new season. And I've escorted some people around, particularly like people who were my favorites was Inger Stevens. I don't know if you ever remember her. Worked with Betty White, who's been a friend. Henry Winkler, when he first started to do his television career, he was here, he's a nice kid. Jack Palance was not a nice man. He was the son of a gun, as a matter of fact. There have been some real stinkers, but most of them have really been delightful people. I'm trying to think of names. Diana Rigg, I was reading about her
this morning
when she was here, when she did the Avengers. We used to get as many as 15 in a row in the early September, and whoever was hot on television at that time would come through here. Robert Wagner. His uncle worked at Kaufman's. And I'm trying to think of other people that. Judy Carn, who was married to Burt Reynolds at the time, she was here.
She was in the Laughing, wasn't she?
That's
yes.
Right, you're right. I don't know why I'm picking these people out of the mess, but Forrest Tucker, who was in F Troop, Ken Berry, who was in F Troop, was here. I also did a couple of big parties for the station at Heinz Hall, and had the good fortune to work with Ben Vereen here, and Bill Cosby, who was not one of my favorite people of all time, and Maureen McGovern, who is one of my favorite people of all time, the singer. I don't know, they just kept coming. I never really sat down and listed them all. I even have a picture at home of me and Key Luke, who was Charlie Chan's number one son and later was in the show of Little Grasshopper, Kung Fu. He just died about a month ago. And I remember we have a picture. So they kept coming, and it was sort of fun, but it was also tiring because you would get somebody who's in a bad mood. Peter Strauss was a great one. You remember, he did a lot of miniseries.
Yes.
And this was when he did Rich Man, Poor Man. And
nice.
Very nice, very bright and pleasant. The ones who had schooling or studied drama at Yale or Carnegie or Northwestern or something, they were usually the better ones. But then you'd run into the bums too, you know, and you always had to handle them. I always try to steer clear of trouble or involvement with them, and picked them up, got them into the hotel, picked them up, fed them, got them out of town. But I made some friends doing that, and so, you know, some of them I've kept in touch with through the years. But it was an art form that I don't think is any great shakes to know how to do. But I think the answer was to usually ask them about themselves, like you're asking me about myself, and they would talk for an hour, so it was easy.
It's very good, David. Last week, after the tape was finished, we chatted a little bit, and you mentioned you gave a class at Pitt. Tell us what it was and what kind of. Did you teach other classes?
No, it was a one-time thing. I had been asked by a woman who was in charge of continuing education by the name of Betty Diskin. And I knew her from the Pittsburgh Playhouse, where she had been an actress, and she had done a couple of shows, particularly one show at War with the Army with my wife, Lucy. And Betty said, you know, among the courses we do always teach, why don't we do one on humor? She said, would you do it for me? So we decided, or I guess I decided, and she agreed that it would be from vaudeville to sitcom, that period of time, say from the 1900s, early 1900s, until television made its debut, how comedy had changed during that time. So we set it up, and I don't know, we had a lot of people in the class. I think we started with 60, and I think we ended up with 50, so most of them stuck. And it was a strange course. Number one, humor is difficult, I think, to talk about or to teach. Historically, you can do it and talk about things that were done. When you ask people to contribute their own kind of humor, you'd be amazed how good taste goes out the window very quickly. And you're always shocked by somebody who looks very staid and proper will then stand up and do something that you wouldn't believe they would do. And in their mind, it mustn't be distasteful. I don't quite understand that element of humor. But so I went through that, and then I found that it was an hour and a half class, and I probably was not a good teacher, having not ever taught before, only lectured to college classes about television. I went a one-time thing, which I've done a lot of, but to sustain a class every week and to have a lesson plan and know where you're going, I don't think I was very good at it. And I found that after working all day, if I went in did an hour and a half in the evening, it was like working a nightclub for me. I was like performing. I did like 90 minutes, and I was exhausted. So after the one semester, we just sort of mutually wrapped it up. I never went back. I don't know that, I don't think I'm a good teacher. I think I'm a performer, and I think that doesn't make you a good teacher. My hat always goes off to teachers, because even when I've been a guest lecturer at the University of West Virginia, or Duquesne, or Pitt, wherever it may be, or high school, I tell you what, when 40 or 45 minutes is up, I'm so thrilled to hear a bell. I don't know how they do that every day. You know, I suppose you learn tricks and you give assignments and tests, but I wasn't real good at it. But we had fun for the semester I did it.
What year was that?
Probably 77 or 78.
And your one-time talks at these various schools are by invitation?
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Are you still doing that?
Yes. I usually go down to the University of West Virginia once a year and talk to their communications classes. I've gone up to Penn State for career days. I do a lot of that. But that's... One-on-one is fine, but I just find, the thing I find most difficult is I've done a lot in high schools, and when you talk to 9th or 10th graders, they don't even look at you. I always pity teachers who work with them. They're so out of it, it's almost, they don't care. They give you an attitude, and to win them over, I take the whole 40 minutes doing that, and then I never get anything done. I find high school very difficult, college easier, because they're sort of career-oriented, and they know which way they're going. But because of the television background, you know, there's a lot of times people will call to ask you to speak to them. I'm going to meet a young man today from Kent through a mutual friend, and I'm going to spend some time with him about television. I do a lot of that.
You also mentioned after our meeting last week that one of the students in your Pitt class was Myrtle Harrison, who is one of our interviewees. Do you have anything to tell us about her and
the Harrisons are wonderful people, and I first knew them through my sister, who was a counselor at Deer Creek.
What is Deer Creek and where is
that? It was a day camp out in Indianola Township beyond O'Hara Township, right? And Dorseyville. And it was a wonderful day camp, and busloads of children would come in every morning. And my sister worked there as a counselor in the 40s. And when I came out of the service, my sister got me to come to the camp the summer of 46 and write a pageant for their wind-up of their summer season. And that's when I first had direct contact with Myrtle Harrison and her husband, Coleman Harrison. Then I went back the following year and wrote them another show, and we stayed friends through the years, and I would see them occasionally, socially, and then they both signed up for my class, which broke me up, and they actually brought tape recorders and sat there and took notes, like I was giving them something, and they're wonderful people, and I just, double-checking with my sister Annette, found out that my father, about 1915 and 1916, bought the Harrison Jewelry Store on Butler Street. That's where I grew up. And this is before my dad was married. So Coleman Harrison and I grew up in the same house on Butler Street at 5157, which I think is unbelievable. And my sister said the other day, great line. She said, when she first told Coleman Harrison, he said, where do you live? And she told him, in Lawrenceville. He said, where? And she said, 5157 Butler Street. She said, he looked like I had said 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
That's wonderful. And for the record, our recorder today and our alternate interviewer is Mary Harrison, who is the niece by marriage, is that right, to Coleman and Myrtle. Okay. You mentioned earlier that on Tuesdays you go with Paul Long to do our town series for Channel 4. What are you doing? Other things for Channel 4 still?
Yes.
What else?
Well, I do some of their special events, like the Pittsburgh Folk Festival. I help them with that. I'm going to help them with their Big Kennywood Day. In fact, I have a meeting today to discuss this. I helped work the telephone for them just this past week for the Children's Miracle Network for the Rehabilitation Institute. They call on me for special projects still. And this one steady thing that I do, the Our Town, and for which they pay me a consulting fee. And if you're interested, I'm also the executive director of a group called the Pittsburgh Radio Organization, which is an association of 12 local stations dedicated to the principle that use radio for advertising, it really works. So they pay me a little fee and I do their work out of my house. And this past year, I have been president of the Pittsburgh Rotary Club in the downtown club, which has been very time-consuming. I'm on the board of the Self-Help Group Network. I'm working on a project for the station for the National Dropout Conference, an educational group that's bringing the national convention here next year. I'm going to work on the vintage car race this summer. I still do some of their social activities, like do the Christmas party for the station every year and things like that. This Friday I'm doing Flag Day at the Flag Plaza on behalf of the station along with Sally Wigan at 8 o'clock in the morning. So I still do some of this.
Tell us about Sally.
She's great. She is probably one of the brighter young people in television. She is a product of the University of Alabama, where her family was living at the time, but she has a master's degree in Chinese.
Really?
From the University of Michigan.
Fantastic.
And she speaks fluent Chinese, and now she has learned Japanese. She's in the Asian Studies program at Pitt. Every time you looked out the door at the station and you saw one tall blonde and 14 small Japanese walking down, you knew that Sally Wigan was taking them on a tour. Every time the group comes through Pittsburgh, Sally entertains them. She's bright. She's adventuresome. She's athletic. She's just an offbeat. She went to India last summer and rode a horse for 14 days with some kind of caravan across India. And she'll do things like this and studies it and gets all ready for it and all revved up. Her dearest friend is Lynn Cullen, who is probably just the opposite. She's very cautious, very staid. And they're the best friends, and they live within a block or so of each other in Shadyside, and their relationship's great, and they're both very bright. It's such a pleasure to have them around because they know how to spell, they know grammar, they have good taste. You know, it's like, yeah, I'm really much, you know, can't say enough good about either one of them.
How about Don Cannon?
Don's very aloof. He's also another very bright man, but he is he's unto himself, and he has never changed. I've known him since 69 when he came here from Chicago. He's really a New Englander. And I'll tell you, his real name is Don Clark, but there was a Don Clark in the Union, so he had to become Don Cannon. But he's very bright, and he knows what's going on. He's well-read, but boy, is he unto himself. I mean, I don't think, I've been with him maybe twice in 20 years. And I would say Paul Long probably not much more than that. He's a little friendlier to Joe DiNardo because they play golf together. But other than that, he's unto himself. He's off in the corner. Here he is.
How about Joe DiNardo?
Joe DiNardo, he's a study. He's a bright man as far as his field goes, which is meteorology, which he considers himself a scientist. And you can kid him all you want about wrong forecasts, but in his own heart, he truly believes that he, you know, works in a science. And he is probably the most affable, outgoing person. He was once asked to run for Congress.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he could have won. I go up with him. In fact, I should be going this Saturday, and I'm not going because I have another commitment. But for the past 10 years, he has a golf tournament in St. Mary's, Pennsylvania, for the Special Olympics. I mean, he could run for mayor, no problem. He turns out just thousands of people for this thing. I usually go up and do the banquet with him. And they love him, and I've seen it when he devotes himself to a charity project, Bundle Up, the Special Olympics, and things like this. He just immediately is capable of fundraising, glad-handing people, and I've gone on a few of his school visits with him.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that.
And after he goes through his ritual, he treats it like he's a presidential candidate landing in a helicopter, I'll tell you. Kids love him. I've seen him lecture in school auditoriums or school gymnasiums with a slide projector. I've even run it for him. On subjects, the kids from kindergarten to sixth grade sit spellbound for an hour while he talks about clouds and why it rains, and he asks them strange names, like who's Enrico Fermi. Anybody know? He's the man who split the first atom at the University of Chicago. Kids will raise their hands and say, he owns a pizza shop. It doesn't matter. But they sit fascinated. I said, my own children, I could never hold 10 minutes with their attention. He holds these kids for an hour, 15 minutes. I think a lot of it is his presence on television. But he's unique. He's unique. In fact, I still write material for him. I just wrote his speech for St. Mary's.
When you mention all the things that you're still doing, even though you're supposed to be retired, you mentioned you were paid for some, but what percentage is paid and what percentage is volunteer? Can you give us some idea?
I'd say it's, at this moment, it's probably 50-50 is about the way it is at this time. I have two major things that are paying me. Once in a while, somebody actually even pays me for a speaking date. Not often, but once in a while. So I do that, and I'll do some odd jobs for people, public relations jobs, if I want to. I'm not begging to do an awful lot, but it's nice if I pick up some extra money. You know,
always.
We use it.
Do you have any hobbies?
Unfortunately, no. I really don't. I mean, I think my emceeing and speaking dates started out as a hobby. And I do work at that. I'm doing somebody's 50th wedding anniversary, some friends of ours, this weekend, and I'll emcee their luncheon. And I did something for somebody last week for a 60th anniversary. And then I've done dinners recently for the Vocational Rehabilitation Center. I have done lunches for the National Conference of Christians and Jews in the last month. And I do a lot of that, and that takes up a lot of time. I probably average 3-4 a month. And I usually write material, and that's my hobby, and I like to write. And if I ever quit these other things, I'm going to start writing a little anecdotal book about people that I've come across, like, you know, Art Rooney and other people that I've had some dealings with. And I don't have a book, but I have a good title. So
tell us your title.
The title is You Meet the Same People Going Down the Ladder That You Met Going Down the Ladder.
Did you say down twice?
That's right.
You meet
the same people going down the ladder.
You meet the same people
going down the ladder that you met going down the ladder. I keep running into these people, and I always think, everybody always says, be good to the people going when you're going up the ladder, because you'll meet them going down. Well, I never got up to the top of the ladder. I'm just sort of hung around going down. I did make notes about people that I've had dealings with that have been funny, and I want to put them together. I don't think anybody will read them, but maybe my kids will read them, so I'm going to do that, I think, if I ever quit.
All this with your hobby, which is your profession, do you have time for social life?
Yeah, not much. We do. I mean, you know, we're theater goers. We eat out a lot. We travel quite a bit in my job. I went to, you know, Hollywood every year for an ABC meeting. I went to the islands for about 17 years in a row, different islands. We've been to Europe once. But my wife and I don't travel well. We're lazy bums. We just don't like lugging luggage. And so I don't know that we'll do any major traveling. And it's sort of tough on Lucy too. She has a little bronchial condition, and she just doesn't enjoy straining herself, and I don't enjoy. I notice her makeup kit gets heavier every year, and I just don't think I want to carry it anymore. So.
Do you want to tell us anything more about Lucy? We do have some information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I gave you. She was born. I told you.
Right.
Yeah, and she was a very good performer, or is a very good performer, although she doesn't do much of it now. Probably a very good attitude from a personal mental health viewpoint. She's usually up, very resigned to problems, very funny, good sense of humor, a little offbeat. I used to say she walks to her own drummer, and he's on Central Time, so she's not real good about schedules, nor cares much about them. Probably very anti-career from a personal viewpoint. Always thrilled that she didn't have to get up in the morning, as she said, put on a girdle and make a living. But she was offered a role just the other day to do something, and she said, that's 2 days of shooting, and sitting around waiting for them to move cameras, and I say no. So she picks what she wants to do, and she's a good artist. She does little arts and crafts type stuff. She's good about the house, and she has her own country cottage kind of house.
I can't read your
writing.
What role was she playing?
When, recently?
Yeah.
They wanted her to be in a segment they're shooting for Pittsburgh's Talkie. They're doing a murder show. And they offered her the part of Aunt Sarah Senile.
That's terrible.
And she was going to be the murder victim. But she didn't want to work two Mondays all day long. And if you do movies or anything, it's ridiculous. I mean, you sit. Now, when you're young, it seems glamorous. When you get older, it seems like a waste of time. She's been a good mother, good wife. I had some problems 20 years ago, burnout, I guess, and everything else. And I'll never forget, after all the physical tests, doctor said to me, maybe you want to see a psychiatrist. And I was so shook when I came home. I told that to my wife. And she said, I'll tell you what, you give me $50 an hour and you can talk to me all you want to. And I did talk to her all I wanted to, and she was a big help.
So did you give her $50?
No. She doesn't even care about money. It's almost embarrassing that she doesn't want to know about it. She considers ourselves poor, so therefore she doesn't worry about it. And nor does she spend it very much. She's a very offbeat that way. She doesn't even like to go shopping.
How do you view your accomplishments?
Well, I was once interviewed for a story for the Tribune Review in paper in Greensburg. It was like a magazine article. And the man who did it, he said, and I think it's probably a pretty good analysis, he said, he never caught the brass ring, but he didn't really care that much. And I think maybe that sort of sums it up. I've probably enjoyed myself more than many people. I don't think I've particularly made great contributions to the world, but I never ever got up in the morning and said, today I make $200, or today I make $300. I've never said that. I never even knew what I made a day when I worked. But I got up and said, today I'm going to do this because I enjoy this, or I'm going to do this because I enjoy it. And I think, from a personal viewpoint, that I've been lucky to feel that way. But when it comes to material things, I probably don't have as much as many people, but deep in my heart, I really don't care. Now, I think if I could have done anything else, we said way, way back in these interviews, yeah, I think I probably would have liked to have been Neil Simon. but I don't know that I would want three wives. And I probably would have had three wives if I were Neil Simon. So, I think you give and you take, and we used to talk years ago, my wife and I, where we were going to head, where we went about our careers. And remember, we'd sit up half the night and we'd say, what have we accomplished? We said, well, we know we're not going to move to North Dakota. That's as far as we usually got. So I think the decisions I made were probably right for me, but I don't think this is a guideline for anyone else, including my own son, who's in the midst of moving to California for the third time now to be back in show business. I don't know if show business is that important on that level, you know. But if it is to you, then it's right. But for me, it wasn't.
Do you have any legacy for you?
Yeah, I probably sounds terrible, but the legacy I'd like to leave, at least the kids and anybody that I'm associated with, is I truly believe in honesty and integrity and education and goodwill toward others. I truly do believe that way, and I've tried to live that way, and I think I could almost run for political office because they'd have to look long and hard to find anything in the closet beside me, that is. So I do feel that way. I do believe in living good with other people, living well with other people.
Any unfinished business?
No. I think I'd like to write a little bit, but I think most of the writing I do is for my own edification. I don't think it's necessary for the world. I hate to sound like, you know, I've wrapped up my life. I don't feel that way, but each day something comes up, and I attack it on a day-to-day basis and try to live through that. And I try to enjoy most of the things I do because I think it's just so much heartache and sadness, and you have enough problems, whether you create them or not, that they're going to come to you. So I'd rather be more positive. No, I don't want to go around the world, and I'd like to see all our children well-situated and happy. And I'm not sure I can live long enough to see that, but I'll try.
I think we have a little bit of tape left. Pardon me? Okay. Can you tell us about changes in Pittsburgh, because you've lived here all your life, significant ones, ones that interest you, or that might interest us?
Yeah, well, I've been out of the town probably, in my whole life, probably 3, 4, maybe 5 years. But otherwise, I've
altogether.
Been, altogether, so otherwise I've been here. And I've seen Pittsburgh, you know, of course, change from a heavy industrialized city to a service city. I feel very positive about the community for many reasons. One is I think we have the good sense, and I don't know where it comes from, but it's here, to preserve the historic. Most cities don't. There was a movie on television, Darrow, the public broadcasting, and they used so many scenes of Pittsburgh, and they were so period, which you probably can't do very many places in this country. So there's a sense of that. There used to be a great sense of corporate and nonprofit cooperation, where the money and the needs were met. Today, there's less of that corporate structure, so there is more being done by the individual volunteer. Pittsburghers are good about volunteering. I think geographically, we're in a wonderful position. I don't think it's terrible that we've shrunk in size. I think a lot of people do, because you want to say, I'm the biggest, I've got the most, I'm this. It's not bad not to be the biggest. I mean, when you drive through the traffic of Los Angeles or Chicago or New York or Boston, it's not so bad here. I think the ethnicity of the city is still wonderful. From the folk festival, when you see young children still doing Croatian dances, where else would they do this? Or now you start to see an Asian element of the dancing, whether it be Filipino or Thai or Vietnamese. They're moving in.
I think the absorption of these people, and I worked a bit in Boston when our company bought a new television, not a new television, but bought a television station in Boston. When Boston first recovered from their textile losses, shoe industry losses, the thing that brought them back were the three elements that Pittsburgh has. And one is the health field, which Pittsburgh is very big in. The second is the educational institutions, and there are like 50 colleges and universities within a 50-mile radius.
How many? 50? 50. 50. 50. 50. 50. 50. 50. 50. 50. 50. 50.
Within a 50-mile radius of all sizes, but they're there. And the other thought is the high tech. There are 700 new companies have opened here in the last 10 years, each employing about 100 people, but that's 70,000 people. They're not the same steel workers, they're other people. Some of the steel industry is over and the people have to realize it, but if you have the health, the high tech, and the educational facilities, you can get strength. Boston only fell apart again because all their high tech was in one company, that was Wang. When it went broke, they suffered. Here we're doing it in a different way. I think it's going to make sense. And I think over the years, Pittsburgh will regain some of its population because younger people will move in here because of the facilities. The housing market is better. We're still a big league town as far as theater, arts, sports. As long as we can maintain those things which draw people, as long as we can draw from a greater Pittsburgh market, whether it be West Virginia, Eastern Ohio, Northern Maryland, and use this as a hub, then I think the market's going to grow here. I think it's a nice place to live. I think it's a... I've worked on a image jingle for this Pittsburgh radio group called Look What We've Got Pittsburgh, and I'm doing 100 times...